Welcome to BizBytes, a podcast focused on technology and business. I'm your host, Anthony McMahon. In each episode, I interview New Zealand business owners and technology leaders discussing their views on the impact technology's had on business, what it might mean for the future, and their thoughts on how to adapt to the changes ahead.
AI is going to take our job, isn't it? Well, the truth is more diverse than that. It won't take our job, but it might become our boss. My guest today is Tim Warren, CEO and co-founder of Ambit AI, a conversational AI platform powering many of New Zealand's leading digital employees, such as Vector, Glassons, and Noel Lemming. Tim's a former developer and has also worked in the finance sector with Goldman Sachs and JB Weir. He's also an investor in a range of early stage companies. Welcome, Tim, and thank you very much for your time today.
Hey, thanks, Anthony, for having me.
I'm going to start with the very simple question because I know that there is often confusion around this one. Artificial intelligence, AI, what's the difference between that and automation, and what's actually meant by AI?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of confusion around what is AI and what is not. And my favorite joke is that if it's on PowerPoint, it's AI, and if it's in Python, it's machine learning, you know. So AI is more really of a marketing term that has been used over the last number of years. I think it kind of reared its head again in about 2015, everyone started talking AI when they were getting sick of big data. Big data evolved into machine learning, and AI was the new marketing term. So let's be clear about a little bit of the history. Going back really early on into the kind of the 40s and 50s and 60s when computing first took off as a discipline, there were two approaches that were relatively well understood from the beginning. One was a purely linear approach, and that's a standard algorithm, you know, X plus Y equals Z. And the other one is a statistical approach, which is we've got a bunch of these and we've got a bunch of those. We've got a new bit of data. What does the existing data tell us about the new bit? And then what is that new bit? How does that new bit of data inform us about the future? So that's the ability to learn. It's had a lot of names. You know, there's aspects of it. Bayesian is one thing. Hey, this is how we learn from data. But fundamentally, it's statistical computing. It's nothing more complex than that. Now, there's a lot of complexity under the hood, the ways you do it. I'm certainly not taking away from that. I think actually it's almost the other way. The term artificial intelligence has probably dumbed down what's really being done. But fundamentally, it's statistical computing. It's understanding probabilities and making decisions based on that.
And I think a lot of the confusion that comes about is most people's encounters with an AI solution tend to come from Hollywood. They've seen Skynet, they've seen R2-D2, they've seen 2001 A Space Odyssey. And so they see AI as this all ever-present thing that's going to be destructive to society. But the reality is it's much simpler than that, isn't it?
Well, in Hollywood, it's 4 minutes and a soldering iron, and all of a sudden you've got a sentient being. So it's not really anything like that at all. It's there's some kind of behind the scenes work that's years and years and years of research, and then they work out the particular fundamental thing that makes something work, and then all of this, and it's AI until it works, and then it's not AI.
Yeah,
AI is always the kind of the next frontier, and at the moment it's the marketing term. And just like I said, everyone was talking about big data kind of around, you know, 2010 for about the next few years. And then that wasn't a very good marketing term. And so machine learning became much preferred way. Now, all machine learning does is it just looks at big data and then tells you some stuff, right? So I'm not going to claim to be I'm not a current developer. I studied computer science and I worked as a developer for 10 or 15 years, and I understand the concepts, et cetera. The development that's going on in the space, it is highly sophisticated, but it comes down to, again, that fundamental thing. Let's use statistics and probability to make decisions where a simple rules engine can't. You ask the question, what's the difference between AI and automation? Well, they work hand in hand. AI is a set of approaches to make decisions. Automation is simply what we do with it. And there's a, probably to relate it to terms that people know, in the back office, call it the behind the scenes in a workplace, we use robotic process automation, which is simply using systems that were designed for people and using computers to push the buttons in quotes. to do that. On the front end, you still have to interact with people. So you need things that understand them, typically their language, natural language, conversation, etc. So that's the kind of the front office worker, the language, and the back office worker, which is the RPA or the automation. Now, there's of course, there's physical automation. We won't get onto that at this time. You know, that's been happening in factories for a long time, but the majority of that wouldn't count as anything to do with AI. It's simply process automation. And I mean, you go back to steam engines, that was seen as pretty automated back in the day, but you wouldn't call it AI today.
No, definitely. And it is something that I've often used in conversations with people where you're talking to a vendor from an RPA perspective, a robotic process automation perspective, and they sit there and go, it's an emerging technology, it's 5 or 10 years old. And I'm like, well, technically the first automated process was the weaving loom in about 1720. So it's not new. We're just using software today.
The answers you get tend to be based on the sophistication level of the person that you're talking to. So if you're talking to someone who doesn't have anything to do with the technology, they'll describe it, you know, like you said, as it's this fantastic new thing. Personally, I'm not a fan of technology for itself. I'm a fan of technology in terms of the way it enables genuine needs, which are business, but ultimately human and personal needs. So you have a range of technologies that you can use, and RPA is, again, it's a grouping of things that we can use for those outcomes and purposes. But it's the outcomes and purposes that are the key here. It's not about, oh, I can buy this shiny new platform and I can push 100 buttons where it used to take a person, you know, 100 hours to do it. Now it takes me 100 seconds. That's not a big sell to me.
Yep. And right now, the situation we're in, obviously, the world is working remotely. No one, with some exception, no one is working in an office. And we're seeing technology enable that ability, not be the ability. You know, we're using Zoom to record this. Zoom is not what's making the podcast happen. Zoom's just enabling us to have that conversation.
Yeah, I totally agree. I've got a saying. I probably borrowed it from someone, but I'll claim it until someone can work out who the source is, that when technology works best, it actually disappears. So, you know, when you're having a really good video call with someone, you're not constantly excited that Zoom's working or Hangouts is functional. Actually, it disappears.
Yep.
And all you remember is the personal interaction. And technology done best kind of disappears into the background. You know, like people imagine, you know, the Bill Gates super automated home to be full of flashing lights and gadgets. Actually, it's the opposite way around. It's virtually invisible. It just does things for you that are right. You know, like turn the lights on or the heating on, and that's nothing special. We've all got that these days. 20 years ago, when he was experimenting in his home, he was trying those things out. But there's always this excitement, this kind of fizz when a new, often a branding on top of a technology is bought out. And at first, those early adopters and those innovators, they get excited about buying the branding. Shortly after that, you get that, okay, so what does this thing really do? What are the actual outcomes? And these are the discussions I like to have with our customers. People might say something like, oh, so have you got some cool AI you can show me? And I'd say, well, first, let me know some of the problems in your business that potentially we could look at. And a lot of those things come down to scale of customer service at a particular time. You know, it's very hard to manage 400 phone calls to a call center that's used to getting 40 a week. If you get 430 minutes, that is very hard to manage. And so in the case of emergency services, or maybe not so much emergency, but certainly if there's crises and you need to manage those crises in an incredibly scalable way, humans deal very well with complex problems. They don't deal very well with high bandwidth volume problems. So the way we see it is that technology augments people and enables them to solve real problems, but it's a person solving a problem for a person. And if you can see that, and I'll give you an example. So one of our customers is Tower Insurance, and their most common claim that I understand is a windscreen claim. Now, it's a relatively easy one to deal with because there's no specific assessor involved. If you've got a cracked windscreen, it's a cracked windscreen and it's covered. So they were finding that people were calling up. You know, you spend a bit of time waiting on the phone, you talk to an operator, they're very helpful, they take your details, maybe they call you back at some stage if it's busy, but the end-to-end process is taking a certain amount of time. What we found, when you let people solve it themselves, they can get through, they can make a claim through, you know, through a natural language digital employee or a chatbot. They can make a claim. They even get a booking to go and see Novus to get their windscreen replaced. And a 20-minute interaction has been dropped down to a 2-minute interaction. And one of the benefits that was realized that wasn't initially thought of was the saving for the insurance, the policyholder themselves. Yes, you save the time in the call center, but that person has gone from spending maybe 20 minutes on the phone down to spending 2 minutes through text or through an easy interaction in the place and time that they want. They can do it 24 hours a day. So those are the enabling functions. So we've got a retail client, Glassons, who's been impacted. And, you know, obviously their stores have been closed through this lockdown period. They do sell some basics though, so to a certain extent their warehouse is able to fulfill online orders. So they've got busier. They are dealing with more people online through certain channels than they have previously at all. And it's not just a one-off change. That's a pointer to the direction of the future. And one of the things with this time is to say, hey, what are the things we're trying now? That where we can use technology, we can use automation and new ways of working that we can build on in the future.
Absolutely. And within there, I think there's a really good point that's often overlooked is that customer pain point. It's the opportunity you can solve for your customer. You know, you talked about Tower. Anyone who's ever rung a call center can relate to the experience of being on hold for 20 minutes while you're in the queue, spend 30 seconds, maybe a minute with an agent answering the question and resolving the problem, and then leaving, and suddenly they've wasted 21 minutes. But, well, they haven't wasted, they've got the outcome they need. But a digital employee allows that, it removes that wait time, it speeds up the service for them, and they walk away with the exact same answer, but 20 minutes
more. You're right. There's a series of things there, and if you think of it as a full process, there's the initial contact time. Maybe you're waiting 10 minutes or even just 5 minutes, but that's 5 minutes you don't really want to have to wait. Now, when you can have a technology that immediately responds to you, you know, one of the single biggest determinants of satisfaction of customer service is how long you wait to get a first response. It's not how well it's handled. Correct. Yes, people want that. But if you immediately jump on the connection with someone, you can empathize with them, understand their needs, and even if it's just scheduling a callback. You know, one of my favorite improvements that came out about 10 years ago was when you called certain government departments, you know, you knew that you were in for a 2 to 3 hour wait on the phone, and that's a killer. As it said, is this the phone number we should call you back on? We can call you back in 1 hour, push hash to continue or something like that. So you, out of that, you get so many things. You get a queuing mechanism. It calls you back at the right time because you don't call someone at the right time for you. You call because you have to, and you know that you need to call at 9 a.m. because it could be a 2 or 3 hour wait. And if you wait till lunchtime, you're stuffed. So instead, 11 at night, when you know, oh, geez, I need to deal with that thing, you might be able to resolve it in 1 or 2 minutes. And those things that tie back to that human need that you talked about. Relating it to when we're talking with our customers, and we've got predominantly enterprise customers, they're big businesses that deal with large numbers of customers. We don't put in solutions for them if there is no explicit need. If they just want some cool technology, we say, hey, well, thanks. I'll take that title of being cool, and maybe I'll take that as a testimonial, but we're not going to put that thing in for you because we haven't fully understood your need. So the interesting thing that does then is it enables us to have that conversation about customer outcomes, their customers. It's not really about them. People don't typically, some of these digital employees are used for internal purposes like human resources and service desk. They're very powerful for those. But predominantly it's because you've got a vast number of customers, maybe your vector, and you've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of customers, and you want to be able to deal with them in a responsive way. What do they need to know? This is the something I've determined. You know that almost every business has one question that they need to answer. If you're Vector, the question is, when's my power coming back on? But thankfully, because Vector's, you know, is a really good company, we hardly ever have to ask that question. But when we do, was it March 2 years ago? Half of Auckland was out of power. 350,000 households were without power. That's a lot of people that want to know the answer to that one question. Now, humans, as I said, are bad at dealing with volume. If you've got a very complex inquiry, humans are fantastic, and I don't think we'll replace that need in our lifetime. But what we can do is we can put technology in place through automation so that you can reserve the very smart and very adaptable humans for those complex times and keep the volume running through a more effective, more efficient method.
And there's two parts in that that I want to explore as well, Tim. The first one is volumetric. So what you're talking about with Vector there, you touched on emergency service as well, is a single call from a single location can convey criticality. You know, it's urgent. This needs to happen right now. Yeah. And it may well be. And it's up to a human to determine that. But you can also feed criticality based on the 150 calls you just...
Volume. Got. Yeah.
Volume. Right in that area, in a 30-second period or a five-minute period, you've suddenly taken a 150 calls, it's probably critical.
That's right. And there's a couple of bits of magic that we can do in there. And I call it magic because this can be done. It's done by a limited number of companies. But Stats New Zealand has an area that's working on using their data to create these amazing insights. So, for instance, they can track cell phones where they are at different times of the day. They collect, because they're not competitive with the telcos, they can collect all of the telco data in an anonymized way, and they can look at movements of large numbers of people through time. And Google's just done something similar, but they pull in a vast amount of data. Now, when you can see, for instance, say again, your Vector, I think that's a really good use case. You can see through Vector that you're getting a cluster of calls come in. Without having a human involved, you can see where the problem is. You can even dispatch a team to go and start to address that problem. So those are the kind of things that we like to put in place. Now, the ways that you can do that, there's a number of ways. You can have the conversation with people through an automated means, like a digital employee, and you're getting both sides of the conversation. You can learn from that text, and you can create a topic model or your conversation modeling to understand what are the topics that are being talked about. The big word in the bubble chart will be outage, and probably the area where they are, and you know when's it going to be back on, and these kind of things. This is very hard to get from people just visiting your website, because the main page people are visiting is your front page. Maybe they look around and they click on outages, but it's not really telling you the same thing. The other thing that you can do is you can, an interesting interim, you can listen into phone calls and listen for keywords and generate an understanding just from the discussion what people are talking about. Now, it can be done in a completely anonymized and private manner, but you can bubble that information up within minutes. And you can bubble it all the way up to senior management. So I could potentially have something popping up on my phone. If a certain search term hits a certain level, like say complaint, say you have the word complaint mentioned 100 times within an hour to a call center of some particular company, that could go to the head of customer service. It could automatically alert them with no other systems. At the moment, there's things like NPS, which is very retrospective. It looks backwards, and maybe a couple of days later, hey, you talk to the person at XYZ company. How did you think that went? It's a bit late by then.
Yep.
that might work for some things, but it doesn't tell you actually what's happening. And we live in a world where, at the moment, our world's dominated by that kind of 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock update from the Prime Minister and the Director of Public Health. Our entire economy is hinging on those particular times. You can't wait a month for data about the economy. And there's been a discussion around this, hasn't there, around getting data about the economy much more in real time. Using conversation in terms of what people are talking about is a brilliant way to do that as well.
Definitely. And using some of those examples as well, I know call centers, and particularly within banks, have been using voice pattern recognition software to better improve a customer experience. So they've got the voice recognition software at the start of the queue, you know, tell me in a few short words what you're ringing for. And they can use stress points and pattern points to actually start routing the call to the best person to deal with it. If it's a simple query, I can't log into my internet banking today. We'll pass you to a junior member of the team because that's something they've got the skills to deal with. But if you're ringing up talking about multi-structuring your home loan or you've just lost
loan, a commercial loan or something.
Get sent straight to the best person instead of the old model of, oh, you've come through the wrong team.
The ladder. It's that skills routing, right? So you do it based on the availability of the best person to solve it, so they can ideally solve it without that escalation to another human. As soon as you move from human to human, it's very hard for humans to transfer knowledge. We have this pathetic bandwidth of about the speed that we can type or talk, right? Machines don't have that bandwidth issue. It's instant, and you do it in the same machine, as it were, or they're talking to the same instance, even within different instances, and you can pass the entire corpus of not only the knowledge around that specific person and their particular inquiry, but of all people, all inquiries, and what's likely to be the problem.
Yeah, and I've explored this previously on the knowledge pyramid, where it conveys exactly what you're saying. The further away from the source of the message a message moves, the more it can be translated, or the more risk it is of being translated. You know, the single source of authority is the person who said it first. And if that's someone ringing a call center with a query, and it's captured by a system, it will follow them everywhere instead of having to be repeated.
And we've had systems like that. You know, obviously broadcast is a one way of that. And we mentioned that with, you know, the Prime Minister's briefing every day, which is one of the most watched pieces of media at the moment, and using up plenty of bandwidth. I always noticed that my connection slows down during that time, and it's a good idea to avoid your video calls at that time. However, that is inherently one way. And it's only when you get that repartee, that backwards and forwards like we are doing, that you can get a genuine understanding of both sides, because you've got that explanation of a problem and then you've got the clarification or qualification of the problem.
Correct. And even using the Prime Minister's broadcast, there's a dilution in there as well, in that the questions that we want to ask may not be asked. The media are the ones there putting it for them.
Now, there's only one of her, right?
Correct.
Although it seems like a few countries want a facsimile. I think she's got an offer to be the Prime Minister of the Great West Island as well. Yes. But it shows you the importance of communication. You can get it really right and you can get it really wrong. But if you've only got a point source in communication, that's a problem. And that's where technology can enable humans to be individual sources of expertise and then route people to the right person to solve that problem.
A term you mentioned earlier, digital employees. And you put that into the context as well, that these aren't replacing your people, they're augmenting your people.
Yeah.
Perhaps let's explore that a little bit further as well.
Yeah, well, businesses have a handful of fundamental things they want to do. They solve people's needs in return for some kind of a economic benefit, right? And to do that, they have costs and they have income. So there's a couple of sides that you can play with there. You can save people money, or you can generate them revenue. Fundamentally, that's the only thing that that businesses are there for. Yes, there's some wider plans, there's some mission, there's some things, but that's why you have a business as opposed to not having a business, right? So how can you apply technology to each one of those things? Well, with cutting costs, it's a sensitive topic, especially at a time like this. It's not a key driver for a lot of businesses. They need to maintain sustainability. Most businesses, in fact, all businesses that I talk to, are desperate to keep employees involved and engaged. What they want is more productivity, and productivity is moving people up so they can operate in a more effective way. They can assist a company in generating more revenue, etc. There's a saying, you know, you can only cut to zero. So to be successful, you have to generate revenue. So most companies look at a combination of efficiency, productivity and revenue generation. So the typical discussions we have is this. We're working with a company, say, and they're growing successfully, but they find that as their growth rate increases 10%, they're having to add 20% to their call center. So my first question to them is, let's look at your process to ensure that you've got scalability. Usually they've done that because we're always dealing with some pretty smart people. The next question is, what are the things that you can do to enable that growth, to enable that to be more effective, so that if you grow 10%, you're maybe adding 5% of cost to your call center? And digital employees are one of those technologies that do enable that. Digital employees don't do a great job if you've got zero employees. They work best hand in hand with people. What they do is they deal with the volume problem, so people can be assisted directly by people in the complex areas.
It's something you talked about in there, the efficiency is that bringing technology in makes your valuable resources more efficient.
Yeah.
Therefore making your business more efficient. Therefore it's sort of this interrelated equation for it all, isn't it? That productivity gains and efficiency gains will actually drive revenue or cut costs somewhere else.
It's a little bit like adding oxygen into the fuel supply of a combustion engine, right? You put a little bit more oxygen, there's more ability for it to burn the gasoline that it's got, and then it goes faster. And the whole economy works like that. The economy can be described, it acts like a bit like an oven. It's not really like a light switch. It's not on or off. It slows down and it speeds up. To do those things, you have to do them progressively. So you want to find there's a combination of iterative improvements, small improvements over time, and then occasionally you get a step change. And I think we're experiencing a time where a lot of people are experiencing step changes in their business.
Definitely, definitely. And there's nothing stopping them from having multiple capabilities powered by digital employees, is there? They can have a conversational AI, they can have a recommendation engine, they can have these things working in tandem. It's not...
Look, again, like people, it's like having a diverse team. I think this is the moment in the world economy where we've passed that tipping point. Cloud and remote is proven, right? But for diversity of thought and diversity of skill, it's the same with your artificial intelligence workers as well. All of your digital employees, the ones in the back office and the front office, they can do multiple tasks and they can do it in a radically different way to the way that humans can do. You know, it's pretty hard to have someone both working on a shop floor and also packing boxes for your online store, for instance. But that's the kind of thing where you can have multiple dedicated machines helping in those areas that makes everyone more efficient. So you add this, it makes everything 10% more efficient. You add another factor, it makes everything 10% more efficient. But it's about how you combine them, and you bring a key point here. Specific points or solutions can often be really good at the time, and they can often be a bit disappointing later on, because often they'll get you quite a good jump early on, and it's a little bit false, because that's not something you can continue to utilize. It'll give you plus 10%. What you're looking for are solutions that multiply the output. So times 1.1, you know, add 10% more in a multiplicative factor, in a multiplication way, so that you can add a series of things. And I guess what I'm getting to here is that a single one-off fix you can put in at this stage, but it's not going to deliver you benefits after, say, the initial jump. So you've got to keep adding them. What you want to do is put in a platform that supports a whole range of areas of your business. So you asked that question, can you use them for multiple use cases, essentially? So if you're an insurance company, yes, you can do claims, and that's really good. And that's an efficiency and a productivity delivery. What if you can use them for selling insurance in the first place? And I'll shift on to another example of a customer we work with, Squirrel Mortgages. They use our platform for mortgage not so much pre-approval, but an understanding of how much can I borrow? You know, would I be able to buy this house? You know, I've got this much deposit. How much could I borrow in total? That kind of thing. And it's really efficient. It's kind of fun. People do it in their own time, in their own way. And that is something that can be done in volume. In fact, it's very busy at the moment. Clearly, there's a lot of people having mortgage discussions. But if they then want to add another thing, say they started selling insurance, or say they started making small business loans, you can build on that same platform and you don't lose the benefit of all that training that you've had. Now, if you've got, you know, one chatbot that does one thing and one that does another and one that does another, that's confusing. You can build that diversity into the same place. But to do that, you need a platform, and you need a platform so you can rapidly deliver out to your customers.
I've seen examples that you talk about where companies have tried to build out multiple chatbots to cover multiple solutions. And if you put the customer hat on, it's just inelegant. It's where do I have to go? It's why some websites are underutilized, because if you find where you need to go to get the answer, you're probably not going to do it.
It's a key thing that our platform looks to resolve, because if you put on the first chatbot, they work really well and you're really happy with it, but what about that second one? You know, you've got a sales case and then you've got a customer service case. Those two things, different products, right? So what you need is a platform where you can do that together. And a good example is, if you get an AWS, you can build anything on it. If you get a Salesforce, pretty much anything across customer needs, you can build into that. So when you're having conversations with customer, it's like having a private banker. Who doesn't want to have a private banker? You talk to one person, they solve your problem. So it gives you the ability to treat everyone like a special customer. The human, yes, is the icing on the cake in terms of very complex query resolution. But there are so many ways that having a single conversational interaction can improve. And I'll give you an example here. We're working with a company at the moment about to release something quite substantial. They already had live chat, and then they realized, oh, live chat, it's about 50% more effective than simply using people on phones, but that's a one-off game. There's no ongoing scalability. And then they said, well, our concern about adding a chatbot or a digital employee is then you've got the live chat bubble on the bottom and you've got a digital employee. So we set about to resolve that. And so what we've done is we have a single chat interface on a website, and then we can route it either to, it could be to Zendesk, it could be to any one of these other platforms, or we can automate it. And what we talk about is automate first, understand the problem, and then route it to the right human. And that's the kind of thing you can do with a flexible platform instead of going for those point source solutions. Imagine a company with a diverse set of services. You could have 10 little speech bubbles down the bottom, and that's not a great user experience. No one's going to do it, right?
No, definitely not. And it's a word that keeps coming back up throughout this, and it ties into the theme of what we're talking about as well, human, people, staff. What we're saying here is that these solutions aren't taking the jobs away. To tie it back into the theme you've talked about, what they are doing is assigning the work for the day in real time, where once upon a time a manager would have sat down and said, right, Tim, you're on that queue, and Anthony, you're on that queue, and Susan, you're managing that queue. What the AI is doing is actually going, oh, well, Tim's available and he's got the skills. I'll hand this one to him. Anthony's available and he doesn't have the skills, so I'm going to wait till Tim's ready. Oh, no, Susan's free. We'll pass it to her as well.
Absolutely. And those routing engines have been around for a little while, and they were used initially through, you know, the much dreaded IVR, you know, where you try saying something a few times and then you push a button and then you push zero 20 times till you get through to a person who does it right.
Or you just stare at it and it fails over nicely.
Yeah, but when you can have a conversation first up and get a sense of what they're talking about, remember, you can automate this. So you can have a voice conversation over the phone with a digital employee, which asks you that question, you know, tell me in brief what you're talking about. You can turn that into a transcript, you keep the audio, and then you put it in a queue for the right person and give that right person a queue. This person asked this question and this is what they want. And that's if the automation can't solve it directly. But there's an example within a bank that I'm aware of, and they have thousands of pages of documentation just about how to approve the credit for a mortgage. In fact, I'm sure all banks are like this. The hardest thing they have is not the documentation itself, it's finding the right thing. So they are experimenting with ways of using chat or voice to do really quick voice searches. And just with a 10-second description of the problem, the three key documents are popped up in front of them. And that's an internal use case. So that's brilliant as well.
Absolutely. It saved money. And like you said, there's the opportunity for the bigger companies to use a digital assistant, a digital employee internally from an HR perspective, from a technology help desk perspective. Again, it's not replacing the roles that it's doing. It's augmenting the capability the team had.
Yeah, that's right. And so we do that with Vodafone. We support their human resources function. And it's exactly for that. They've got an HR, Ask HR inbox. And, you know, that's a very large organization, a lot of people, a lot of questions. But it turns out that 80% of the questions can be asked, can be answered by about 10 typical responses. So when you can automate that away, again, you're freeing up people. And so the internal use cases, they work really well for large companies, because with large companies, you've got a lot of people, you've got a volume problem that you can solve, and you tend to get that 80-20 law falling in place.
Yeah, definitely. So looking forward, what do you think the future holds for intelligent automation, for machine learning? Where do you think we're going to end up in the next 5 or 10 years with this?
Yeah, there's that phrase, I can't remember where it came from, that most people overestimate what they can do in 2 years and underestimate what they can achieve in 10. And anyone who's gone through a career change is well aware of that. So I think there's probably three phases worth looking at. I think there's a key understanding at the moment that there's an aspect of resilience that people are going to understand through the current period. So efficient businesses have been prized by the market until you get a crisis. And then efficient businesses tend to be in trouble. They suffer an extreme event through the crisis. They need bailouts or they go out of business. And we've already seen a couple of examples of that in New Zealand. And airlines are quite a good example. They're so capital heavy. They try and run really efficiently. But when they lose their revenue all of a sudden, it's a really tricky time for them. So it does tend to suggest that people have to find a way of including digital innovation as a necessity rather than an option. When we talk to a lot of the people in the innovative areas of companies, and I can tell in their voice, they feel a little marginalized. But at a time like this, it's all of the things they've been putting in place that are heavily relied on. A move to cloud is a great example, you know, working on VPNs or ensuring that people have, I mean, just the move to laptops has fundamentally enabled people to work from home in such a powerful way. So I haven't had a desktop in probably 10 years. So there's a handful of things like that. If we look specifically at automation and AI, what it can do right now. So there's going to be a urgent shift to customer service through digital first means. You can't just put hundreds and hundreds of people on the front line to do a job that a machine can do, because you can't mobilize that number of people in such a short time. And in this environment, it's not even safe to do it, even if you can. There's some people, it's a bizarre reshuffle of the economy at the moment. Countdown's hiring hundreds or thousands of people, and the company next door will be dropping hundreds or even thousands of people. So how can you avoid those rapid swings? So using automation to address high scalability, high volume problems, it needs to be seen as a necessity. If you're not doing it, you're fundamentally failing to understand some of the key risks in your business. So if I'm a director right now, I'd be really worried about my general business, whatever it might be, whichever part of the economy, understanding how exposed you were, even if you're benefiting financially because you're providing an essential service that's in high demand. Maybe you're shipping flour or toilet paper. You're also worried that the next thing that comes, you won't be able to predict it. You might be on the other side of it, and all of a sudden, no one needs your product. And there's plenty of examples of that. So what can you do? So there's a range of things that are more broadly economic, or the, kind of the microeconomic factors that you can do. You can have a more resilient business by having multiple income streams. And I, what I've looked at is the businesses that have they have ongoing periodic revenue, say monthly or annual subscriptions, they're much more robust with a longer term relationship. If you've got something where you you have to go out and buy it every time, people can just stop. If you've got someone who's on an annual subscription or a management fee over a longer period of time, they're going to keep that on, or much more likely. So finding ways your business can move to that. Now, to achieve those things, you have to have superior customer service. You have to be able to deal with people 24/7. You have to be highly scalable, you know, as in the case of someone like Vector. The other thing is that as companies develop, I think over the next four, kind of the fallout from this, I think over the next 2 years will be a catch-up. Over the next 4 years will be an embedding into a company culture, much like HR was kind of in the 80s and 90s, and a stronger understanding of risks at the board level was built in through that 90s and the 2000s. And then out of the GFC, we learned that you need to stress test these financial institutions for certain cases. And I think we've got a brilliant example where financial institutions have managed very well. The regulation that's been put in place has served its purpose, and we've had very adaptable policy that supported them. The next thing is to have that in technology policy. So what are the things that you can do to put in place so that you can deal with people in their way rather than the way that you were dealing with them 50 or 100 years ago? You know, phones are pretty old. You've got to move on, you know?
And there's something in this as well. If we use the supermarkets as an example, I was talking with my wife yesterday about the upswing in online shopping, and Countdown here in New Zealand has just opened up another dark store where I think they're talking about able to service 7,000 customers a day. If that's the way of the future for shopping, and people have adapted to it very quickly, there's actually a big risk for some of those smaller food manufacturing companies who rely on supermarkets as part of their distribution chain. If they're not visibly getting their brand in front of people on an aisle, how are they selling? So those are the ones as well that are going to have to look at digital innovation.
Look, I think I read an article 2 weeks ago, and it said just about everything that's happening is playing into Amazon's broad strategy, right? It's unbelievable. I mean, they've got warehouses that you're talking about. They've been running this. It's the core part of their business model since they first started. Originally, they had no stock, of course, but as soon as they realized that they could be more efficient by having some stock, they put warehouses all around the world, moving into fresh food, contactless payment. It's AWS and all of the highly scalable tools that they've got. It's quite frightening. They're already the largest company in the world, and what's this going to do for them? They're just about one of the best placed. But I like that, because what you're talking about is actually a genuine human concern. A lot of the businesses, I think, is it 70% of the businesses in New Zealand have 20 employees or less, and they're really vulnerable. And I really feel for my local butcher. He does the, with his team, they do the best meat produce that money can buy, and I want to be able to access that. But right now, he's struggling to have a Vector to market. So I do agree. I hope that the big business doesn't squash small business through this time. And I think small business has a way of managing and competing. They need to do the things that big business can't. And the key thing there is move fast.
Correct.
Big business, if you've got a 50,000 square meter warehouse shipping big brand product out, then there's a certain slowness of that. So what can you do as a smaller company? Well, I mean, I bet you've got a whole bunch of tools in your kit bag around how companies can move. And one of, I know that an organization, Zealed, a web and e-commerce technology supply company, they have delivered, I think it's in the order of 400 or 500 e-commerce websites over the last few weeks at very nominal or no cost to small businesses just to enable them. And I think this is, you know, that we talked about the tipping point. I think this is the tipping point where people will realize that these innovative digital ways forward, they can't be left. You can't just be a boutique in a high street store. You might have a beautiful $500 jacket, but if you can't show that to someone online, they can't necessarily buy it. Yeah. Do I want the jacket? Yeah, but like you said, if I can't see it,
absolutely.
Problem.
And that's where some of that food will come into it. You know, you tried new things because you saw them at the head of the aisle or at eye line in a shelf. You're not going to see that anymore. So that company that was selling that has, one, they've got a risk that their produce won't be shipped in the traditional manner, but they've got a huge opportunity to go e-commerce, to go online and start to promote themselves in a different way. And we might even see that, bold prediction, but we might even see the move away from supermarkets as the dominant force of the food supply.
Look, you raise an interesting point there. I think that it's important. I love looking at history because it pretty much tells us stuff that's happened before. The market was where all kinds of individual vendors went to sell their stuff. And you went to one place so people could choose it, right? And then that became the high street. That became the shops. The supermarket, they just said, hey, we're going to have one of all of those and we're going to put it in one building or whatever it is. But if we look back at the origins of the market, imagine a supermarket of the future where every brand is available directly. It's kind of like you mentioned Amazon. It's kind of like everyone in the Amazon store. That at least gives people equal potential opportunity. The question is, how do you get that aisle space and aisle time? Well, supermarkets have been charging for that for a long time, and they've been pushing really hard bargains with people, pushing down margins in order to get that eye line space. So what are the ways that smaller businesses can compete? Look, some of it is going to be through digital marketing efforts, but then again, you know, Countdown or whoever it is, they have access to those tools. So, I think it's about talking with people like yourselves and finding really agile strategies. Move fast is a really key thing. You can't hide your way out of this. You're better to run. So find a new strategy, get some data, see if it's working, try something new. What I do understand is that this is incredibly exhausting for a small business owner who has been focusing, you know, maybe you think of my sister's, the cafe that my sister works at. You know, they've been a very successful cafe on a high street for many years. Their business was turned off overnight. How do they reinvent their businesses? You know, their business were moving to home delivery once their kitchens can open, moving to different ways of providing services, maybe still being that source of hunting and finding the great quality products.
And
it's not all technology enabled either. It's human enabled. It's just creative humans thinking about brilliant solutions to meet people's needs.
On that point as well, it's something you talked about, having to look to the history to focus on the future as well, look to the past to focus on the future. It hit me last year about when one of the supermarkets here offered click and collect and online ordering, just how far we'd come in a full circle. You know, if you go back to our grandparents' generation, the way they shopped was they'd go to the local greengrocer with a list.
He'd pick it.
He would either deliver it or he would let them know when it was ready to pick up.
Yeah.
We then went through the supermarket evolution where you went and did that all yourself. And now we're at this point where you send the supermarket a list and they pick it and they either deliver it or they let you know.
I love it. That's a good one. I think you've found that example. I think there will be numerous examples where people actually, in some ways, they don't have to be innovative. They just need to do a bit of research. They need to have some respect for, you know, talk to your parents. I talk to my parents. And I talked to them, goodness me, this is going to be a time like no other. They said, oh, nonsense, polio. We were home for 3 or 4 months. We loved it, they said. So, you know, they were from that generation where things happened. They got through it. They said it was one of the best times, heaps of time with your parents. Did it impact their learning? No, they loved it. And so I'm not belittling the impact on business at all. But what I am saying is that there are a lot of historical precedents for interruption, for change. You know, change happens in a couple of ways. It can be insidious and creep up on you. It can grow over time. It can come, you know, like an earthquake. But the only thing you can do is find solutions that have a level of resilience that can do a couple of those things, contain your costs and let you develop revenue.
What's the best way to get started?
Yeah, little. Do something small. Get started quickly. The biggest mistake with technology is to wait too long just because you think the next thing is going to come out. You know, I actually still know one person who's got that classic old Nokia waiting for the just the next thing on the latest iPhone. And you don't want to be that person. Do something small. Be prepared to learn. If it's not like AI and automation is not like software of old where it was monolithic. It took years and hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop. Do something quick and efficient that's now and be prepared to learn. And you have to keep doing that in the cycle. Also, once you've put something in place, don't think that it's done. You need to keep revising it. The business cycle of the kind of, unfortunately, it's a lot has been driven out of these kind of capital cycles of business with a 7-year amortization period. People were, you know, they were putting a piece of software for 7 years and kind of ignoring it apart from a couple of patches and fixes in the meantime. And then they go through this massive exercise. You don't want to do that. Get started with something small. Work with a local company that can give you a high level of support and roll something out really quickly and then learn from it. And you need to be learning and improving and upgrading. I'd say at the moment, our customers are operating on a day to weekly kind of a basis in terms of rapid improvements, but monthly is a baseline. I don't think we'll ever go back to it being sensible for people to make a 7-year commitment to a single monolithic piece of software. I think those days are gone. So be the opposite, be the small company, and everyone can do it. Small companies can do it. And big companies can do it in the same way.
Absolutely. And I like your point about stay local as well. Find a company that can support you, that understands the market you're in, and work with them. You might outgrow the relationship over time and naturally evolve, but that's a good thing for both of you.
Yep.
It also means that you're investing in that local knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just like your question around the local retailers or the more boutique sellers of product. If you're just looking for a commodity product, sure, you can buy something in bulk online and kind of thing. If you want something that's a bit better than that, you have to invest. And the difference a lot of the time is not just the product, but it's the people and the service that's wrapped around it. For instance, I go to my local butcher because he actually butchers it better. It's beautiful looking food. And to me, aesthetic is important. And so when you're getting something designed or some automation put in place, getting something where you've got, hey, I know that if I've got a problem, I can call Anthony and I can get a resolution. I know that Anthony, not only does he care, he knows my first name and he knows what my kids are up to. He's really going to care. And it's almost like I want to find the people who are thinking about me at 7 o'clock at night, thinking, oh, you know, maybe Tim just needs that one more thing. I'm just going to drop him that email. Those are the people that get you through an awkward time.
Definitely, definitely. Hey, look, just as we wrap it up, something I'm putting to everyone, and it's interesting the themes that are coming through, but what books are you reading at the moment? What are the things you're reading that are helping influence your thinking at the moment?
Good you ask. I always have many, many books on the go. So I'm reading a book called The Cold War. Let me just grab it so I can get the name of the author. So it's this one here by Odd Arnvestad, The Cold War. It tells you exactly what it's about. It goes back a lot further than you might expect. It goes back really to the 1800s and virtually the Napoleonic era, actually, to have an understanding of what happened. And it goes a lot further forward through to the current time. In fact, it's got a lot of references to things that are going on. I'm also reading this one here, which is called Closing the Ring by Winston Churchill. It's one of his World War II series of books, and I have a huge fascination in Winston Churchill. He's a very unusual character. He was a funny crossover between being one of the last, he was in the last mounted charge of the British cavalry. He was a colonialist. He was also the first Cold Warrior, and did many, many things, including being voted person of the century, the last century. Fascinating guy, immensely interested in history. And I have just finished, reading a book about industrial psychology. I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but I started reading that before the current crisis. That's three of the books that I'm working through at the moment. the modern period from that I look at from history kind of starts around the time of that revolutionary period and kind of was at its peak with Napoleon. But when you look at the similarities between, I mean, one of my favorite books is Tolstoy's War and Peace. Napoleon went on a very similar journey to what Hitler then tried to do into Russia. And if you look at those as analogues for what happens, I mean, it becomes more of a political, political learning, I guess. But given that that drives so much, and you're seeing it happening at the moment, the divisions between different approaches around the world. But I use those, I think, as a guide. If you simply take a look at the information you've got today and look forwards, you can have a lot of anxiety. When you look forward and you have a high level of uncertainty and you look too far forward, it's very hard to be strategic. We mentioned this just before we kicked off the podcast, actually. Being truly strategic at a time like this, it tends to drive anxiety because you've got no idea. You've only got about 1% of the required information to make a decision about what your company looks like in 5 years. So at the moment, people are operating on a day-to-day basis. In fact, we've come out of that now. We're probably a lot of people on a week-by-week basis. And if we look at the New Zealand lockdown rules, there's a few rules announced this week. It's going to change probably next week or the week after. We're in a weekly phase. And most people are doing that with their company. Now, the painful thing is to look up to the next stage and say, okay, how do we manage by month? How do we manage by quarter? How do we manage by year? And you, as a leader in a business, you have to look at least one stage beyond where everyone else is focusing and be at least prepared when those next things come up. We had a board meeting 3 weeks or a month ago, and then we had another one a couple of days ago. And that's the way I described it. We don't have to look down at our feet to see where we're stepping at the moment. We can at least look out. But it's a little bit like having a car which has got headlights that are slowly getting stronger. You know, you can look out 10 feet, you can look out 20 feet. And yep. That's the reason I use history to go back and look at these other, earth-shattering or defining events to see how people managed it and the fact that they did manage it. And that's really important.
And they managed it with less than what we've got now as well.
Oh, yeah, without the technology. And this is the thing. It's not about the technology. The technology enables us to manage it. But man, the 1918 flu, they didn't have any of this technology. A handful of people had basic phones. A handful of people, you know, you're more likely to have a horse than a car. You could argue that social isolation was a little easier in those days, but people had a much lower understanding of the transmission of diseases. But you know what? Humans are incredibly resourceful. And I think if we describe all these things as they are aspects of human conditions, there will be human solutions to it. If we keep that at the forefront, we'll get through this period and be able to focus on a really interesting new normal.
And look, I think it's a great point to stop because both of us have got an interest and a fascination in history. We could take this for another 4 hours if we
yeah. It's another. That'll be a different series. We'll talk about the Carthaginian Wars or something.
The difference between a Macedonian phalanx and a hoplite phalanx as well.
Yeah.
Hey, look, Tim. It's been really great talking to you today. Now, if people do want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to reach out? Through LinkedIn?
Yeah, definitely through LinkedIn. Connect with me and engage with me there. Drop me a private message. Obviously, you can find my company, ambit-ai.com. Come there, look at a video, etc. But LinkedIn's where I am pretty much every day and where I continue to engage with a large number of people.
Hey, look, Tim, really great talking today. Thank you very much for your time and all the best.
Thank you, Anthony. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to BizBytes, brought to you by The IT Psychiatrist. Check out our blog at www.theitpsychiatrist.co.nz/blog for bonus material and more information.